It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right, welcome back to Money for Lunch. I'm literally eating my lunch. I was just wrapping that up. It's, I'm trying to live up to the brand name there. I sometimes do have lunch on Money for Lunch. All right, well, good to have you here. Always good to have you here. It's because of your show suggestions, your guest suggestions that this show is really for you guys. And I'm so grateful that you allow me the opportunity to serve you in this way. Always fun. We're going to get started here right away with my first guest, Amy Mendoza. Amy Mendoza is an attorney, a mom, an entrepreneur. She spent 15 years in the tech industry before leaving it all to start her own estate planning law firm after her own experience with beating cancer. Amy is the owner of the law offices of Amy Mendoza here in Tempe, where she focuses her practice on both estate planning and small business law. And the website, mylawaz.com. Amy Mendoza, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, you know what? And I want to talk about this a little bit. Give us a little bit of your journey there, because obviously here you are in the tech industry, and you had this experience with beating cancer. And is that the thing that kind of made you want to go into this area of estate planning?
It was because I had a, whoa, oh no, what's going to happen if I don't make it through this moment? So, you know, being in law school, I signed up for the estate planning class and figured out what would happen, and it scared the heck out of me. So it kind of pushed me toward, you know, deciding whether what I was doing every day in my world was something that was fulfilling me and helping people. And I decided I wanted to dedicate my life to helping people not feel the way I felt in that moment of panic when I got some devastating news.
Sure, sure. So let's talk about this. What happens to your business if something happens to you, the business owner? Walk me through this.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because as business owners, we all treat our business like our baby, right? It's our child. You know, it's time and time again, you see business owners and entrepreneurs striving and pouring their heart and soul into everything that they do with their business, just like they do with their children. And I found it interesting when I started in this field that I was meeting with families who had kids, who wanted to make sure they were prepared for protecting their kids in the future when something happens to them. And then they owned businesses. And on that side of the fence, it was like, okay, yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're kind of shoving what would happen to the business to the side a little bit and not really thinking about it. And the scary thing really is that what happens is it becomes part of your estate. So if you don't have something in place to plan for what would happen to your business if something happened to you. I've seen some really scary things happen to people where, you know, your son inherits the business and he's 12. So then it goes into, you know, the probate court and he's not legally allowed to own a business. So somebody else has to petition for it. And then you got people coming out of the woodwork. And then of course there's no money to support all this, you know, hubbub. So the business goes under. I mean, it just happens so much because there's so much that you need to plan for in your business.
Sure, sure. And this thing, you mentioned probate, and a lot of people are not familiar with probate. And so probate, and you correct me if I'm wrong, this is a kind of a niche area of law, typically deals with, you know, final expenses, final reconciliation, usually not necessarily with the business, but a business can be part of it. But typically when somebody passes away, if they have a will, it goes to probate and the court kind of sorts it out and makes sure everybody gets what they're supposed to. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah, you're very accurate in that. The one thing I would add is that, you know, I explain probate by saying probate is when you transfer an asset, when you're living, you like sign a piece of paper and you say, I buy this house because I'm signing all these documents, and I sell this house because I'm signing all these documents. Well, when you can't sign anymore, the court has to substitute a process to oversee that your signature would have been effective and the people that are legally supposed to receive your assets are receiving them. So that's what probate is. Unfortunately, it oftentimes starts, though, before people are even gone, because if you're unable to sign because you don't have the capacity to sign, you have dementia or you're in an accident or something like that, the probate court comes into play earlier. So as a business owner, if you're not planning to try to avoid that process, because honestly, it takes forever, it's public record, it's, you know, it's expensive, and, you know, it's basically the government kind of up in your biz.
And I like that.
Who wants that, right? There's great ways to get out of it. And I'll tell you, the other day I read, we all know the whole Prince saga right now, I read all of Prince's court documents. I read them. And I know home addresses of all his family members. I know his last known home address. I know all this private information because it is public record. So scary. And you don't want your business, you know, out there.
Well,
literally. Your
and here's something from my own personal life. When my mom passed away, she had a will. And what I learned about a will is that the will is better than nothing, but not by a lot. So if
where there's a will, there's a probate. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. If you have a will, you will go to probate. And let me tell you, my mom had a modest estate, and it still took 2 years to get through that system. For a modest
estate, it's annoying.
And something complicated like, you know, we've heard about Howard Hughes, Elvis Presley, and now Prince. Mm-hmm. It could literally last decades.
Yes, it could. And the thing that I'm on a mission, I'm on a mission to educate people about this, because the thing about it is that it's completely optional. If you have the right planning in place, you don't have to do it ever. You know, everything can be private. Everything can be taken care of by who you want, when you want. And, you know, especially for a business owner, this is for Prince's estate, and his business is, he was so involved in that every single day, but without a plan for what happens to it when he can't be there, it is going to be, you know, six siblings fighting over everything because they've all got an equal share.
Sure, sure. Well, let's talk about this. Not only Prince, but I know that you had a similar story, or not, I don't know if it's similar. You had a story about a farm family that kind of went through some of this. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, this is a really sad story. It was actually a really dear friend of mine's uncle. Had four young girls and a wife. They owned some farmland in the Midwest, and he worked, you know, night and day on that family farm. He was the guy who ran the farm, and they made a really great living on that farm. But without any planning in place, of course, all of this was kind of going on. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he was in a tragic car accident. And he passed away. Mm. And so what happens now? I mean, the girls don't know how to run a farm. They're young girls in school. His wife wasn't running the farm. She was taking care of the family. So, of course, you know, my friend and all of his relatives jumped in to try to help, you know, run the farm for a period of time. But people, you know, people have lives and people have things to do. And, you know, they ended up with this situation where they basically lost the entire farm. And, you know, his wife was left having to start over. And it's such a shame and such a bad story, but it's all so avoidable. And with the proper planning going into place before something tragic happens, this could all have been, you know, funded by life insurance and sold and taken care of. And there could have been a key person insurance in place that could have done something wonderful to provide for the family and getting someone else to come in and run. You know, just it all fell apart because there was no plan.
Right. And there, what's the old saying? If, you know, if you fail to plan your if you fail to plan, you'll plan to fail. Right.
That's
it. So let's talk about this key man insurance or key person insurance. What does it do? I mean, And when should I have key person insurance?
Well, it's interesting because I've had a lot of people come to me and say, well, I'm thinking about getting key person insurance. I should, right? And I'm going to get that and then everything will be fine. And I'm like, well, you might need it, but what are you going to do with it, right? Because, you know, key person, and of course, I'm not an insurance agent, right? Okay, I'm not trying to sell key person insurance, but it's one of these really vital tools when it comes to planning as a business owner, because if you're the guy running the farm and something happens to you, with key person insurance, you can, or some people call it key man insurance, you can come in and have a set of money or a lump sum of money or some sort of payout of money that's there to do certain things. So it could replace you. It could hire someone to come in and do your job. It could be there to support the family and the business and keep it running while it's getting ready to be sold. There's a number of things that it could do to carry the business forward. Yeah.
Okay. So how is that different, let's say, from life insurance? So if you have, let's say, a $200,000 life insurance policy or $200,000 key person insurance, how are they different? Because they sound somewhat similar.
Yeah, and they kind of are similar. Your key person insurance is going to be specific to your role in the business and how's the business going to carry on. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then your life insurance could be used to buy someone out. You know, buy-sell agreements are often funded with life insurance policies behind them. So it could be used in that respect, but it's more geared toward the family and continuing the family than the key person insurance is geared toward carrying on your business, you know, that baby, taking care of that baby.
Gotcha. So where the life insurance is really just for the family. And so, again, the farm example that you gave, if you all of a sudden want to hire somebody to run that farm, then that key person insurance would be used exclusively for that while you figure out what you're going to do with the business. Instead of shutting it down immediately, now you have enough funds to maybe keep it open for 6 months or a year till you figure it out.
Exactly. It's basically life insurance on that person who's key to your business for the business. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, I want to recap our conversation so far. I want everybody to, stay with me on this. If you have a will or if you don't have a will, you will end up in probate. You will have, as you like to say, Amy, the government will get up in your business there, and you have to take specific plans or measures or steps to avoid having all the stuff become public and letting the government get in your business. And it's not that difficult to do. So what is the process? If I want to set up an estate plan, walk me through that process.
Well, you know, there's good and there's bad in any industry. So
sure.
A good process would be to find somebody that you're comfortable with sitting down and having be your trusted advisor for life, basically, on this area. Because it's not about, I'm going to go in and have a one-shot transaction and sit down with somebody who's going to draft up some things for me to sign and go home and put on a shelf and never look at again. It's really important for you to find someone that's going to take the time to sit with you and learn about everything you have and everyone you love, is what I like to say. Because once you sit down and cover those, I mean, my first meetings with clients take at least 2 hours because we want to really get to know them, their history, their goals, and really kind of customize and personalize things for them. Because with your traditional cookie cutter, here's your trust sign on the dotted line, people get in trouble with those. So, I mean, I would say the process needs to look like a lifelong relationship with somebody that you trust as your trusted advisor, as your attorney, really.
Yeah. And not to, play on words there, but it's kind of funny because you said, hey, this is, you know, somebody to help you through life, but it's really to help you through death.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not there, you want to make sure that everybody gets what they're supposed to. And again, trying to avoid the cost and sometimes litigation that happens when you go through probate.
Yes. Yeah, and it's interesting because we talk to clients time and time again after they come through the planning process with us. I mean, it takes us about 3 months to do an initial plan. We have multiple meetings with clients to get everything put in place for their initial plan, and then we meet with them every few years after that to make sure things are updated. And really, it's we find that people get to the end of this process through planning, and we're talking about your end goal. You know, people talk in business a lot about what's your one-year goal, your three-year goal, your five-year goal. Well, if you look at your end-of-life goal for what you want to leave as your legacy and plan backwards from that, it's so much more clarifying. People see see everything so clearly when we do that with them. So it's while it is about planning for your death and your legacy, it impacts your life in such a super positive and awesome way as well.
Sure. No, absolutely. And let me tell you, you mentioned Prince and the fact that you were able to go to the court records and look at where, you know, Prince's information, all of his family's information, their personal address and things of that nature. What a scary thought. And to avoid that in itself, to me, estate planning is well worth it. But could you imagine, and hopefully this won't happen to Prince, but sometimes when a lot of money is at stake, people get ugly.
Yes.
And when you don't have those clear, plans in place, questions come up and now you have to have a judge try to interpret the best wishes or your intent to distribute your assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and someone can look really good on paper in front of a judge, and they can still be the last person that you want involved in anything that has to do with your estate. You know what I mean? We've all got those people.
Absolutely. I love that. It's a great idea. Amy, we're out of time, but I'd love to bring you back and talk more about estate planning and protecting us. If you guys have questions for Amy Mendoza, you can reach out to her at mylawaz.com. She's here right next door to us here in Tempe. Amy Mendoza, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me.
Good stuff there about you and your business, your life, your final expenses, if you will. We're all going to die. Maybe not me, because I plan to live forever. But most of us, I think, will die. And you know what? It takes just a little while to protect your family from all the junk that we see some of these people go through. So remember, if you have a will or if you don't have a will, it will go to probate. It's going to cost you more money, and people are going to be able to find out all your personal stuff, whatever's happening with the assets that somebody might have left for you. So just think about that. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
To Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Dr. Beth Darnell. Dr. Beth Darnell has researched the inadequacy of the medical establishment's current response to people with chronic pain. She is well-versed on the terrible side effects of opioid medications and can speak to how we wound up with our current epidemic of overdose deaths. She understands how psychology and emotion are connected to the pain response and can speak about how patients can help themselves get medical assistance to control their pain without pills. Control pain without pills. Dr. Beth D. Darnell, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, hi, Bert. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You bet. Let's talk about this a little bit. are we having a lot of patients that are over-medicating themselves to the point of overdose or death?
So opioid overdose deaths have been described as an epidemic in the United States, and that's really put forward from the CDC and the FDA. And what the data have revealed is that more people are dying from overdoses that include opioids as they are from car crashes and other, you know, typical common deaths. Now, the one caveat there is that we're not really able to know how many people are taking opioids illicitly. For instance, heroin. Heroin's an opioid. So how many people are dying from prescription opioids versus heroin? That's tough to tease apart. But what we are able to see is that over the years, there's been a huge increase in opioid prescribing for chronic pain, and we've seen in tandem an increase with overdose deaths, and these are largely unintentional overdose deaths, meaning, you know, they happen accidentally.
Sure, sure. It wasn't, as you said, it wasn't intentional. They weren't doing it because they were sad or whatever. It's an accident that happened. And what's interesting to me is this kind of information is rarely talked about. It's not common knowledge that this has become so epidemic, is it?
Yeah, you know, it's become bigger news, certainly. It's been in the front page newspapers a lot, and more so, it's huge news for people who have chronic pain, who are suddenly finding themselves caught in a firestorm with the CDC telling doctors, recommending that they really limit opioid prescribing. And so to a person with chronic pain who maybe has been using opioids for years and years, this is a very terrifying situation because people are left wondering, okay, now they're going to take away my medication and I'm just going to be left with more pain. So you can imagine how that would cause a lot of stress and anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, bottom line is, if this is all you have, because this is, you know, what do you call it, the only resource you're accustomed to, this would be extremely, extremely frightening. So let's talk about this. What are the alternatives? I mean, let me ask you this. If opioid medications don't really work to control chronic pain, then why are they prescribed so often?
Yeah, you know, Bert, that's a really great question. And I want to start off with a caveat by acknowledging that for some people, they do work well. It's a minority of individuals. When we look at the big studies, like population-level studies, we don't have good data to say that long-term opioid use works well. What happens with individuals is they'll start taking them and they seem to work really well at first, but then we become tolerant to the medication, meaning that we'll need more of it to achieve the same result, and can find ourselves with escalating doses. And then in combination with that, there's side effects to the opioids. So there's data that shows that taking opioids for a long period of time can actually make a person more sensitive to pain, meaning that it actually worsens pain. And that's counterintuitive. I mean, we're taking it to help our pain, but it can actually contribute to things getting worse. It disrupts hormones. It's not good for sleep. And these sleep and hormones, we know that when we have those changes, that can also contribute to pain getting worse over time. So what we need to do is we need to focus on not just putting limits on opioids. We need to treat pain better.
And I like that. Because it's not, like you said, it's not enough to say, hey, don't use opioids. It's, okay, well, what's the alternative? And real quick, I want to talk about this. I want to plug the book. The book is called Less Pain, Fewer Pills, Avoid the Dangers of Prescription Opioids, and Gain Control Over Chronic Pain. It's by Dr. Beth Darnell. and it's available on Amazon. It also comes with a DVD? Is that what this is?
It's an audio CD.
It's an audio CD that includes enhanced pain management CD. There it is. I should have just read that. So let's talk about this. What techniques help patients need less medication? How, you know, what are the alternatives to controlling my chronic pain without meds?
So, excellent question, Bert. And I want to start out by talking about what pain is. You know, we all know that pain hurts. We think of, you know, it being that sensation in our body that we want to get rid of. We want to get away from pain. But actually, pain is more than just that sensation you feel in your body. It is, the definition of pain is that it's a negative sensory and emotional experience. That's the definition of pain, is that it necessarily involves our emotions, it involves our psychology. And when we experience pain, we automatically have responses in our body that help us prepare to get away from it, these stress responses. So our muscles will tense, our breathing will become short and shallow, we will have chemicals expressed in our blood. We're actually hardwired to get away from pain, to want to get away from it. This works really well for us because it helps us survive. So if you have, you know, just short-term pain, these responses are going to serve you well. But in the case of chronic pain, where let's say you have ongoing back pain, migraines, or fibromyalgia, having these automatic pain responses, not only do they not help, they actually work against you. They contribute to the worsening of pain. And so the trick is that we have to train our nervous system away from pain. We have to train our mind and our body to be less reactive to the pain so that we're able to contain it better. And this is really the realm of pain psychology. I'm a pain psychologist, so I help people learn to train their mind and body away from pain. And by doing so, that means they need less medication.
Gotcha. And I like what you said there. Look, pain is not, it's not necessarily bad. It is telling us something's going on. It's giving us some feedback, right? So if we didn't have this sensory called pain, then we could potentially hurt ourselves. We wouldn't know when to stop.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if you're placing your hand on a hot stove, feeling pain it's a good thing because it's going to help prevent damage. It's going to help prevent injury. But once we have chronic pain, that pain is no longer a useful signal. It's not necessarily signaling harm or damage or danger, but we may be responding to it like it is, and we may start doing less and less and less. And in fact, one of the best treatments for back pain, for instance, is exercise. But if we feel pain, we're going to be less motivated to exercise. And so then that becomes problematic. So a big trick with pain psychology is learning to overcome our natural responses to pain, you know, wanting to do less. We actually have to help ourselves do more, but to do it appropriately.
Yeah, I think that's a great distinction there, because if you're suffering from chronic pain, it's not the same thing as the short-term pain. So let me ask you this. So here I am. I want to start tapering off these medications, these opioids. What do you suggest? How can pain sufferers taper off?
Yeah, so here's what we know. A lot of people will, even though the opioids may not be working very well, there's a lot of fear around stopping them. It's common for people to believe that stopping opioids or tapering off opioids will lead to more pain. But in fact, research shows that very slow tapering off of opioids does not lead to more pain, that people actually get better. They end up having less pain, better mood, they're more active. And so that's right off the bat, it's helpful to know the facts about tapering. Now, the trick is to do it wisely. And so you want to talk to your doctor about a very slow taper. Obviously, don't stop the medication cold turkey or go too fast, because that will trigger withdrawal symptoms that are miserable, and you may then falsely believe that you can't get off opioids. Everyone can get off if they want to, but the trick is to go very slowly, to have a really smart taper program.
Gotcha. Okay, so are opioids then, are they addictive, or is this psychological, that this addiction or this addictive response, is it psychological then?
So opioids are certainly addictive, but not everyone gets addicted. In fact, a minority, a small minority of individuals actually become addicted. But virtually everybody who is on opioids long term will develop a physiological dependence. And so that's true for you, for me, for anyone who would take them long term. The body and the brain get used to this medication. And when that level of medication drops suddenly, it triggers a withdrawal response. It's very stressful. And so that's what needs to be avoided. A person can be physiologically dependent on the medication and not addicted. So it's important to understand the distinction.
Sure, sure. No, I like that. I like that. All right, so again, the book is Less Pain, Fewer Pills, Avoid the Dangers of Prescription Opioids, and Gain Control Over Chronic Pain. It's by Dr. Beth Darnell. It comes with the book includes an enhanced pain management CD that kind of, imagine it walks you through some of these strategies.
Yeah, it is a CD to help people calm their nervous system, because this leads to pain relief. And used regularly, people can train their brain and their entire nervous system away from pain. So it's non-opioid pain relief.
I like it. I like it. You know, and what's interesting too, I think we've all seen the latest barrage of commercials about opioid-induced constipation.
Yeah.
And you know, and so now they want to give you another drug for the drug you're taking or the drugs you're already taking. cycle of meds.
Yeah, it's true. And so, you know, then we can be taking medications to counteract the hormone changes and the sleep problems and the constipation. And so rather than getting more and more complex, it's really nice when possible to look to simplification, actually going down slowly, tapering off the opioids, and helping people gain control over their own experience, over their nervous system, and over their pain.
Yeah, yeah. You know what? And I want to do this, if you don't mind. I want you to talk. One of the individuals that you cite in your book is Brenda, and specifically Brenda. She was, I guess, a private detective, and a lot of what Brenda did to help manage her pain was breathing. Talk about that for a sec.
Yeah. So one of our automatic responses to pain is that our breathing becomes short and shallow. It's like our body is bracing itself, protecting itself against pain. And so we get these changes in our breathing that sort of become second nature. They become automatic over time. And one of the techniques that we can use to help pain is to reverse this cycle, this tightening in the breath. Because when the breath is expanded, when we breathe diaphragmatically, it kicks off a cascade of relaxation throughout the body and the nervous system. And what the research shows is that leverages your brain away from pain. So it helps calm everything in mind and body, reduces suffering and discomfort. And that will help you in the moment, just like with Brenda. She talked about how she almost, like, with pain, she would almost stop breathing. She would catch herself where she was barely breathing at all. And the solution is to coax mind and body into a state of deep relaxation because this counteracts pain. The trick is to use these skills regularly because we're learning to train the brain away from pain. And using those skills on a daily basis is what leads to lasting relief. So we don't just want to treat pain in the moment. We want people to achieve lasting relief that leads to less need for medication.
As you said there, a nice little rhyme, train the brain to deal with pain.
Train the brain away from pain.
Train the brain away from pain, Dr. Beth Darnell. The book, again, is Less Pain, Fewer Pills, available at Amazon. It comes with a enhanced pain management CD. If you guys are dealing with chronic pain, you know somebody that is, this is the perfect book. Check it out. Dr. Beth Darnell, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Albert, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. Good stuff there about chronic pain, how to manage it, how to train your brain away from pain and some of these harmful medications. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. Hey, we were talking about dealing with pain. Our next guest, Larry Shaliga, is also going to help us deal with some different kind of pain. Larry Shaliga is a founder and president of Results Oriented Coaching. He has over 40 decades of management and consulting experience as a manager. He has a remarkable career, progressing from first line production supervisor to CEO, working at a variety of private and privately owned and publicly traded company. He most recently helped grow a small privately owned $10 million company into a $150 million worldwide organization. Shaliga Consulting, Shaliga's consulting clients have comprised some of the world's largest organizations, including General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, Westinghouse, GE Medical, and Colgate-Palmolive, just to name a few. As a best-selling author, he is the co-author of Transform, motivational speaker and consultant with Ryan Tracy. Shaliga is sharing his proven strategies and concepts and techniques. Larry Shaliga, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hi, Bert, and thanks for having me on the show again. How are you doing?
You bet. Very good. Good to have you back.
Good.
Let's talk about this because you have seen, you've had this very successful career. Again, some of the stuff that we talked about, taking one company from $10 million to $150 million. What do you attribute your success to?
I'm glad you asked that. There's a few things, actually. The first one is recognizing that to make sure that I do everything I can to make those around me successful. If they're successful, I'm successful. It's a hard stone to throw because a lot of times we've caught into the trap that I'm focused on my career, I'm focused on my advancement, and I have to do what I'm going to do to succeed. But that trap turns people against you over time. When you focus on making them successful, you automatically reap the benefits. The second thing is to make sure that you listen to them. You have to listen to the people around you, and that means paying attention to what they're saying and not preparing your answer in advance while they're talking. actually thinking about what they're saying and with an idea that you're going to learn something. And then the last one is to recognize that you don't have to have all the right answers. Matter of fact, the only one that expects you to have all the answers is you. The other people around you have just as much gray matter, and respect them. Ask the question, admit you don't know the answer, and most of the time they'll come up with the answer with you.
Sure, sure. You know,
does that make sense to you?
I think it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that it took me a while to learn is that when you expect yourself to have all the answers, then your ego, your pride gets in the way, and it's hard for you to form friendships or relationships or alliances because you put this unrealistic pressure on yourself.
Absolutely. And then at times, I've often caught myself concentrating more on being right than having the right answer.
Yes.
That's an easy trap to fall into.
It is. It is.
And I think others.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was saying that if you turn to the others around you and listen to what they're saying and not force yourself into a situation where you have to be right, you can come up with better solutions. And better solutions that people give you, you get better buy-in.
Let's talk about this a little bit because, again, you're talking about engaging, empowering, and developing other people. So how do you go about doing that?
Well, there are several different ways to do it. One of the things that I like to do, and I've just done this a couple of times recently, I had some 14 managers in companies around the country. They don't talk to each other. They're isolated. And as I went around and talked to them, they explained how they felt and they can't get any help. They call the corporate office for help, and you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning, they have an emergency, and they get a call back at 5 o'clock at night. So we got them all together and just started talking about what are the problems, and we let them go. We had what we would normally call a bitch session, if you will, and we just let them go. And the more they talked, the energy was very, very high. And then we changed it to, okay, instead of sitting here complaining about what's going on, what are the possibilities? What are the things that we can do? In years past, as a manager, I always focused on facilitating the meeting, making sure it was nice and orderly, and one person talking at a time. Control and order was the name of the game. Now I let them go. And they form off into small subgroups. They start having conversation amongst themselves, and I just let them go. I walk around and I listen and give them some time. And when things start to slow down, I tell them, hey, in 10 minutes we're going to wrap up. I want to hear what your ideas are. This particular group came back with – they formed a network where they talk every month by way of telephone and go-to meetings. They brainstorm ideas. If one of them's having trouble, another one will jump on a plane and fly out to help them. Or they'll call each other on the phone and discuss the problem. They'll come up with a solution. In essence, they've eliminated the need to call the corporate office. They've empowered themselves to make the decisions on their own. And they draw on each other's strengths and experiences. So they're not as dependent on other people at the corporate office that also have full-time jobs.
Right.
So they're very engaged. When they come up with the answers, they're just jumping in and doing it. So they're empowered to make those decisions. And I got to tell you, the energy and the motivation is great.
You know what? And part of what I'm taking away is if people are allowed to be empowered, they can sometimes come up with a great solution.
Well, I'll tell you what, I walk past engineering on a regular basis, and I'm still not an expert. If I walk through, watch these people do their jobs, they're the experts, I'm not, no matter how many times I walk. So when there's a problem, if you can engage them in the solution, you're going to come up with a better solution, and you're going to have better buy-in. And buy-in is 90% of the solution itself. You get people trying to figure it out. If the first idea doesn't work, if they're bought into it, they're going to find a better way. So, you know, from my experience, you know, we don't have to have the answers, but we have to be able to help draw the answers out of our people. And then we have to support them and give them the resources and the information that they need.
Yeah.
It's all about making others successful.
Sure, absolutely. And it's also, you know, again, getting our ego, our pride out of the way. I'm not talking about having pride in a job well done. I'm talking about that ego pride that gets in our way and is harmful to our growth. That's what I'm talking about. Get our ego and our pride out of the way, and wonderful things can really happen.
I think you are so right. And it's a hard trap. I mean, even after, and it's four decades of experience, I still find myself getting caught in that trap where I feel I have to have the answer. They're looking to me for the answer. So
right.
it's an ongoing discipline to stop yourself and stop saying, okay, guys, I don't know the answer to this. What do you think? Sometimes they look a little stunned, but I think it's nice for them to realize that you're also human and we're all in this together.
Right, right. Let's talk about this because in today's environment, you know, we have cubicles. We have all this, quote, digital communication. You have, you know, email. You have texting. You have, Snapchat, all this other stuff. How do you get people to really get involved, to get engaged?
Wow. You know, that's a problem that I see growing on a regular basis from day to day. I've got people in offices right across from each other that don't even talk to each other. They'll send an email. And you watch back and forth, emails back and forth. It takes them 20 minutes to solve a problem that a 10-second conversation would resolve.
Right.
Again, forming networks, getting the people out of their cubicles, getting them to sit down around the table, talking to them, even going out, taking them out for lunch. It's amazing how many times you go out for a casual lunch and people start talking about work. For me, I enjoy getting the people together. I enjoy asking questions, listening, and helping them come to the answers. They know what the answers are. The cubicles and the digital communication, in my mind, tend to separate people and put them back into silos. We don't work effectively in silos. We are herd animals. We're social animals. So people start to climb inside themselves and build barriers. And the more barriers you build, the less trust you have. It's when people start talking to each other. And as managers, as leaders in organizations, I think it's our job to help pull these people out of those cubicles, put them into situations where they can talk and actually enjoy talk. Right now, I think a lot of them avoid it. I think that they hide behind the email. It's a lot safer. It's a transmission
sure.
of information rather than a discussion. So discussions are not easy. We don't practice them, and we're getting further away from it. I mean, walking across the parking lot, you say hi to somebody, you say, hi, how are you? And they say, hi, how are you? And you turn around and say, yeah, I'm fine, how are you? Well, I just asked that question. I didn't really expect it. I didn't expect an answer. You shocked me. Our society is moving more and more towards that.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting,
too. You do a pretty good
job
talking and drawing things out.
Thank you. What's interesting, too, is we have this society, I should say this generation of young people who fit exactly what you're talking about. They are so used to connecting, for lack of better terms, via their phone, right? That, you know, they're constantly looking down, but they don't know how to interact in a live scenario. They don't know how to interact in a job interview or anything like that. It's the weirdest thing.
Oh, it's amazing. And you said that. I was just thinking about it. I was with my grandchildren the other day, and we were sitting at the table, and they were texting each other. the thing that as an older person, you know, I just turned 65, I'm probably not as technically literate as a lot of the younger people coming up. And it took me a while to catch on to the fact that, hey, when I send a text message or an email in all caps, people think I'm yelling at them. I wasn't yelling at them. I was just lazy. so there's little nuances that we're not all aware of. You know, even the vocabulary is changing. A new word in the dictionary every day just because of the digital communications.
Yeah.
And you sit around the staff meeting or any meeting, and it's difficult to concentrate when, you know, you have that little device in your hand or now on your wrist, and people are busy communicating, I'm going to use the word loosely, with people outside of the room, sometimes in the room, which can also create problems.
Right, right.
I had individuals who would sit there, and the speaker's up there making a presentation, and they're texting back and forth, his data's wrong. Well, if his data's wrong, stand up and say, hey, my data's different from yours. But instead, they feed the rumor mill, and then you get a whole new level of mistrust.
Right. And that, to me, is what you call is a great example of an environment where somebody feels safe texting, hey, that information is wrong, but they don't feel safe enough to stand up and say, hey, that information is wrong. And part of that is because, as I mentioned earlier, there is a new generation that does not know how to effectively communicate versus, you know, again, you and I probably would not have a problem saying, hey, you know what, instead of saying, hey, Bert, you're wrong, you might come back and say, hey, Bert, I have different data. Let's see why we're different. You know, there is a nice way of hashing something out. It doesn't have to be adversarial.
If you ask a question based in pure curiosity or discovery, it's much easier for the other person to answer you.
Yes.
If you ask it with intent to trap somebody, they're going to know that, and they're going to respond in kind. But if I just text the message over to the guy across the table that, hey, this guy doesn't know how, we can agree, we're safe, and we feel well, but it doesn't lead us to making better decisions because now we're dealing publicly with false information or inaccurate information.
Right.
But you're absolutely right when you say that we are forgetting how to talk to each other.
Yeah, it's
communication is deteriorating the skill.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's just gotten crazy. And I tell you what, this is something that people forget. The reason that and I think I got this from Zig Ziglar many, many years ago. I think Zig said that 85% of the reason you get a job, keep a job, and move up in that job is because of your people skills. Well, guess what? 85% of the reason that you get, that you get married, stay married, and move and create a healthy marriage is because of your people skills. Your people skills are everything. We know, and Larry, I'm sure that you've met a lot of people in your travels over the last 40 years, people who are brilliant, who really know their stuff, but unfortunately nobody likes them, and therefore they don't do well.
And you know, communicate. If you can't communicate openly and honestly, you'll never develop the respect, the loyalty, or the trust that you need to succeed in any aspect of life. And my fear is, with all the digital communication and the cubicles and our isolation, self-imposed isolation, a lot of those skills are going away. We're deteriorating.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know what's going to be very interesting? Say that again.
I said it is not a good cycle, my friend.
No, it's not. And you know what's interesting, too, is that I think it was Emory University. If it wasn't Emory, it was another top-tier university that said that 47% of all jobs today will be replaced by some kind of computer or robot. Now, that doesn't mean that that we won't have other job opportunities, but that means that once again, as human beings, we have to redevelop ourselves. We have to, get ready for all these changes. And back to what you and I have been talking about, which is communication. The people who are going to be chosen for these new jobs are people who know how to lead. And one of the ways that you know how to lead is because you know how to communicate.
Wow, you just took me back. I had a conversation about a year ago with Peter Diamandis.
Yes, from
and he was saying so many of the same things that you're just saying, that artificial intelligence by itself is growing at exponential rate, And humans are going to have to find a new way to communicate and a new way to manage this intelligence through communication and creativity. He paints a whole new world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, we have Google, a.k.a. Skynet. I mean, look what they're working on, driverless cars. They have robots that are able to respond to being tipped over, and they can write themselves up. You know, they have robots now that can move about freely about a warehouse, pick things up and move them about. So things are changing, and it's changing much quicker than we perceive. It's happening at a much faster rate. And if you are unable to communicate, if you don't have the people skills, then you'll be left in the dust. It doesn't matter how brilliant you are. It doesn't matter that you got that you were top of your class. I forgot what the Italian word is for that. Something culotta or whatever.
My Italian's not that good.
Yeah. but you know, it doesn't matter that you're brilliant. It really, you have to have enough people skills and communication skills to make things happen. You really do.
Absolutely. You know, but if you can't communicate, and I think what you're saying is if you can't communicate your ideas, your creativity, all those things you have inside that brilliant mind of yours, they're trapped.
Yes.
And then how does the rest of mankind utilize them?
Yes. And, you know, and
okay.
What I want to say when it goes beyond that, look, one of the great characteristics of a good leader is to be able to influence people. I mean, to me, that's what leadership is, influence. Get people to act. And so if you don't have those skills, then you're not going to be very successful. You're not going to get people to like you. You're not going to be able to get people to trust you, and they're not going to act and make things happen. So it's not just a getting your idea out there, it's getting people to act on your, you know, and maybe that's what you were saying, but you know, Larry, it's always good to have you on the show. We're out of time. The book, Larry's latest book is called Transform, available on Amazon. Larry Shaliga, always good to talk to you, my friend.
And good to talk with you, Bert. Look forward to the next time.
All righty. Good
Take
stuff
care, my friend.
There. You bet. Good stuff there from Larry Shaliga. Larry, as we talked about, has been doing this for over 40 years. Results-oriented coaching, consulting. If you want to check out Larry and his team, check them out at rocoaching.com. R-O, results-oriented, rocoaching.com, and see what he can do for you. You know, bottom line is, look, guys, we're all here to progress and move forward to our worthwhile goals, right? And sometimes we get stuck. Sometimes we need help. And there's nothing wrong with that. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.